that trusting the people is the surest route to national unity and success. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Excellency. Next, the Prime Minister of Belize.
Excellencies, democracies the world over are facing existential challenges and high expectations from the people we govern. But history tells us that democracy has the infinite capacity to evolve. Even in Belize, with our historic record of progressive democratic consolidation, we have appreciated the necessity of democratic evolution.
It's easy to think that democracy is a collection of fragile institutions on the verge of collapse under the blows of a mindless, illiberal, and jeering mob that is mobilized by social media and disinformation. Democracy is the courts, the electoral system, the parliaments and congresses, its government administration, and it is a collection of unique and uniquely brittle organizations. They need only for people to discard the rules, subvert the rules, and everything comes crashing down. This is a view of democracy as the undefendable. We're all just waiting for the next strongman and his followers to further dismantle all that we hold dear. There's truth to this view. After all, if we can't get our institutions right, and if we can't defend them, we have little chance of preserving the political system that is so dear to us. At the same time, the undefendable democracy view masks the reality of the human side of the equation. There's a need to recognize that democracies, in all of their varieties, are filled with people who seek freedom, genuine freedom, in their hearts and in their imaginations and in their experience. For all the chaos today, there's an unspoken understanding that the majorities of citizens in democracies still desire their liberal freedoms. They want to maintain them and even expand them. Even people who are hoodwinked into accepting the strongmen and their oversimple solutions could be persuaded about the value of liberal democracy if the message is compelling and available. And so we come to the U.S.-convened Summit of Democracy. This grouping of diverse governments of varying levels of commitment to human rights contains many contradictions, but all of them share an understanding at some level about the common convictions around democracy. So these countries include Finland, Ghana, France, the United States, Britain, New Zealand. It doesn't include countries like Qatar or Saudi Arabia or North Korea, and it definitely doesn't include China or Russia. Ultimately, the power of such a virtual grouping may be to organize and highlight the abstraction of democracy in the mind of the global public. Perhaps for that reason, both China and Russia appear apoplectic about the Summit for Democracy. These countries' ambassadors to the U.S. have already penned a combined letter of protest, saying, among other things, that this is an evident product of a Cold War mentality and that it will stoke up ideological confrontation and a rift in the world, creating new dividing lines, and that this trend contradicts the development of the modern world. So there could be no confusion, Ambassadors Qin Gang and Anatoly Anatov state that China and Russia firmly reject this move. The Russian Ministry for Foreign Affairs goes further, releasing a statement calling the Summit for Democracy a quote-unquote strange event. It says that the democratizing rhetoric coming from Washington is not only completely disconnected from reality, but also utterly hypocritical. After reeling off a laundry list of British and American and European failures, excesses, wrong moves, and bloopers great and small, the statement reads, "We can continue quoting examples revealing the hypocrisy at the core of this Summit for Democracy, but is it necessary?" And while rejecting the summit, the Russian statement says, "We will closely follow the Summit for Democracy." You can bet they will. China, meanwhile, has embarked on a social media campaign of who defines democracy. Now, this campaign is a good reminder that on social media, even if the facts are agreed, the meaning can be reverse engineered. China's state media would have you accept the counterargument that no matter what history, political science, and your eyes tell you, China is the real democracy. tens of millions put to death in the 20th century, Xi Jinping given the power to become leader for life, and this is democracy. The landscape of social media is frankly driven by counter-arguments. It favors not consensus, certainly not the kind needed for democracy, but what I've heard referred to as dissensus, or the constant splitting of opinion. And this brings us back to democracy itself. It's not simply a set of institutions waiting to be crushed by extremists or overwhelmed by detractors and bad faith speakers on social media. Of course, it is institutions, but these institutions reflect the time that they were created in and that they were last reformed. If the Summit for Democracy serves any purpose, it's a reminder of how much a process democracy is. Because democracy is simultaneously a form of government, a way of life, and a goal or ideal. Now, that's a definition from Duke University professor John Halliwell made in the 1970s, but it still rings true. Where democracy as a form of government struggles, it remains both a goal and a way of life. It lives on in people's imaginations and sensibilities. And that's where we are today. Communist governments and formerly communist governments will be tempted to claim that they understand the science of history, and in doing so, understand the trajectory of democracies like those attending the virtual summit these days. But they will be wrong. The reality is, no one can foretell history. We can only look at the past. As the Hungarian-British polymath Michael Polanyi observed in the middle of the last century, the French Revolution was the dividing line between an expanse of essentially static societies and the modern period when life has become increasingly dominated by expectations of a better future. Here's Polanyi speaking on this theme in 1962.
In the Western countries where it had its origin, the pursuit of these hopes achieved in the course of the 19th and 20th centuries the most humane and most free societies the world had ever seen. It has engendered an intellectual life of unprecedented range and has led to a new flowering of the arts which rivaled the splendors of Greece and the Renaissance. It has created immense wealth, more equally distributed than before, and nearly abolished poverty.
There's no reason to believe that that idea isn't as true today as it was in the early 1960s when Polanyi, a Cold War culture warrior, made it. The question for me is whether our institutions can properly promote and support and defend democracy in a time when a reality is conceived not through the shared and centralized production of knowledge, but in a new way, through the simultaneously networked and yet deeply personalized world of social media. This, in my opinion, is why a summit for democracy matters. Discussing democracy this way moves the debate away from the complexifying detail of institutions, of technicalities exploited by people who have no interest in the integrity of the democratic system, who generate, nonetheless, endless headlines. Discussing democracy this way moves it into a much broader and more graspable world. It provides a reminder of democracy as an ideal. Basically, it shines a light to move toward. Now, not to be too reductive, but one of the traits of this era is escalating complexity of systems. So it's crucial in this time that there is a way to conceive of democracy as a whole. The summit is a reminder that despite our many cultural differences, nations as diverse as Estonia and Canada, and France and New Zealand, Lithuania and Taiwan, Colombia and Japan, all speak, at a certain level, the common language of democracy. To even discuss democracy as the summit does reminds the global public of the organizing power of the system of government. I don't just mean institutionally or politically, as we saw in the 20th century. I mean mentally and morally. And this has value in a time of infinite complexity. Like I said before, online, even when the facts are agreed, the meaning is easily re-engineered. The last time there was something like this, arguably the creation of NATO, we didn't live in a time of ceaseless information awareness. Back then, the threat of force sparked the need for the common defense of Europe. Today, that threat of force remains. But there's also, really, for democracy, a new threat, and that is the threat of endless information disorder for systems of government that rely on a level of orderliness. The past 5 or 6 years have been marked by the hearts and minds of citizens seeking democracy, questing for the ideal, but lacking the structure, even the mental structure, to secure it. Too often, we're condemned to a conception of institutions and democracy itself that corresponds to the past. Just think for a moment how the apparent bad faith political leaders, pundits, and even political parties know how to mobilize or divide the public in our current phase. Here is U.S. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who came into office embracing conspiracy theory and violent language.
I've been freed. I do. I feel freed because you know what's happening on these committees? You see, we have basically a tyrannically controlled government right now. The Democrats. We've got Joe Biden writing executive order after executive order, sign him, doing whatever he wants up there in the White House. We have Nancy Pelosi leading the Democrats in Congress to do whatever they want. They don't care what Republicans have to say. They don't care about what our districts and our voters have to say. They only care about pushing their socialist agenda through. They only care about taking away our freedoms. That's not right.
U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi wouldn't have to strip Congress members of their committee duties for spouting threats if there weren't an entire technology that richly reward Congress members for speaking this way. Few people serious about a liberal democratic future have thought about what democracy looks like or what it will need to look like in a future where untrue and sensationalist content overpowers the more sober and, frankly, less exciting factual news required for sensible governance. Few have thought about what it looks like in a world where the illiberal regime has little trouble sowing chaos and division in populations whose real unity is only lawful respect for each other. It's worth considering what a world looks like where democratic citizens have all internalized the lesson that what's popular online, by its very nature, has a greater chance of being untrue. Presumably, democracy's institutions would realize the same as well. It's unlikely democracy can thrive unless its institutions can respond effectively to the world as we find it. That is, not the post-war world. Rather, this world today, the one that's been reshaped by information overload. In my last podcast, I mentioned the World War II early Cold War generation that had the resolve and the imagination to properly confront the threats of that era. One of the seminal documents of that time was the famous NSC 68 policy paper that was presented to U.S. President Harry Truman in 1950. That paper set out the shape of the U.S. response to the Soviet Union and basically helped establish the shape and the landscape of the Cold War. The paper contains a key line. The assault on free institutions is worldwide now, and in the context of the present polarization of power, a defeat of free institutions anywhere is a defeat everywhere. And so in the years that followed, there was an effort led by the U.S. to build institutions worldwide that reflected Western democratic values. In fact, people like Michael Polanyi were part of this effort. Just note, the Soviets at the time were supporting institutions and movements that sought to destroy democracies from the inside. Today, the aspiration for freedom exists in a time when conspiracy theories can help shape and distort national agendas, when grifters can earn money by nothing more than speaking radically and collecting funds online, and when the utter complexity of our modern information economy gives cover to endless communication that undercuts civic integrity, whether through trolling, disinformation, or genuine but endless bickering and political infighting. Perhaps for that reason, the value of the Summit for Democracy may be in its place as digital content, an event that stands for a feeling, an abstraction, a shared aspiration, and a resolve to defend that ideal. It can stand as a first step to filling up the space in the hearts and minds of people in democracies, people seeking a sensible, lawful center that struggles to exist and define itself in an utterly decentered and disrupted information world. Simply standing together under the banner of democracy is a modest first move.